this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Certainly, subsequent research, including my own research, has suggested that the Africans in Galveston well knew about the Emancipation Proclamation, but they also knew that it did not obtain in Galveston. There is a Juneteenth that we should pay attention to that in many ways carries more lessons than the traditional Juneteenth of June 19th, 1865. And that is the June 19th of 1867.
Dr. Gerald Horn tells us why the second Juneteenth is significant.
We have always shared in a grand heritage of family, the Black cowboy, volunteering in the community. And for Juneteenth, I remember it so very well since I graduated from Jack Yates in 1963, which segregation was still very prevalent.
Molly Stevenson, founder of the American Cowboy Museum, on preserving Black cowgirl cowboy culture and Juneteenth.
The blues go so high, the blues won't have an end. Just go on and on and on and on and on, like eternity, like the world will never end, but the people will end in it. That's the way the blues are. You'll never die.
And King of the Boogie, composer, blues musician, vocalist, the late John Lee Hooker. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation had officially outlawed slavery in Texas and other states at war with the Union on January 1, 1863. Texas resisted and ignored the order until Union troops arrived on the shores of Galveston with General Gordon Granger on June 19, 1865. Granger issued General Order No. 3 that promised formerly enslaved Africans, quote, absolute equality of personal rights and rights of properties between former owners and those who were enslaved. He clarified the relationships between slaveholders and enslaved as one between employer and hired labor. Freed men and women purchased land and or emancipation grounds for Juneteenth gatherings throughout Texas. Emancipation Park in Houston was purchased in 1872 to commemorate the end of enslavement and to demonstrate cooperative economics. Richard Allen, Richard Brock, Reverend Jack Yates, Elias Dibble paid $800 for 10 acres of parkland. Led by Reverend Yates, they were members of the Antioch Missionary Baptist Church and the Trinity Methodist Episcopal Church. Emancipation Park is not only the oldest African-American park, it is the oldest park in Houston, as well as the oldest park in the state of Texas. During the Jim Crow era, it was the only African-American public park in the entire city of Houston. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Scholar activist Dr. Gerald Horn, author of the newly released book, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow, and the Roots of American Fascism, is here to shed light on the untold history of Juneteenth and how Texas challenged the United States for leadership in the African slave trade. Welcome, Dr. Horn, to the program. Thank you for joining us. You have a new work that's out. We were expecting this work prior to COVID, but of course, it's here now. Tell us about your new work, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas Slavery and Jim Crow, and the Roots of American Fascism.
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. And second of all, let me cut to the chase and bring our audience up to speed about my revelations concerning Juneteenth. The traditional story is that on June 19th, 1865, General Granger and the men in blue show up in Galveston, Texas, a major slave port, in order to apprise the enslaved Africans, who we are told were not aware of the Emancipation Proclamation, that they were free. Now, there's so much wrong with that traditional story. Number one, the Emancipation Proclamation of the Lincoln regime on January 1st, 1863, did not extend, obviously, to Texas or to other parts of the slave South that were precisely in rebellion against the Lincoln government. It would be as if the United States government passed a law that said that the remnants of slavery in Mauritania and Northwest Africa would no longer obtain. Well, the U.S. government has no jurisdiction in Mauritania, and it would be null and void. They would have to send an army there to enforce that diktat. And precisely that was what was happening on June 19th, 1865. In other words, General Granger and his forces were showing up to impose a new order, more so than telling people they were free who apparently did not know they were free. Now, for some reason, that traditional narrative plays into an antiquated idea that Black people were somehow aware of the events that were swirling around them. And certainly, subsequent research, including my own research, has suggested that the Africans in Galveston well knew about the Emancipation Proclamation, but they also knew that it did not obtain in Galveston. Just like, as I will detail momentarily and detail at some length in my book, after June 19, 1865, it's not as if slavery disappeared from the landscape in Texas. Just because you have a law, even with guns to back it up, that does not necessarily mean that there will be some transgressors who try to violate that law. I mean, for example, I've been made to understand that it is illegal to use cocaine. So should we infer from that cocaine is not used in Texas, for example? Yeah, it's obviously ludicrous. So here's the story with regard to Juneteenth. There is a Juneteenth that we should pay attention to that in many ways carries more lessons than the traditional Juneteenth of June 19th, 1865. And that is the June 19th of 1867. What I mean by that is that, as many of your listeners know, during the U.S. Civil War, 1861 to 1865, in an opportunistic fashion, France had seized Mexico. That leads to the Mexican-American holiday of Cinco de Mayo, which represents and marks an uprising against French rule in Mexico. By June 19th, 1865, Texas, the slave state which was least damaged by the U.S. Civil War, was banking upon the French occupation of Mexico to continue the revolt against Washington in order to perpetuate the enslavement of Africans. In the event that that diabolical plan was not able to be launched, the idea was that the enslavers of Texas would move en masse, oftentimes with their African so-called property in tow, so that the enslavement process could continue south of the border. But what happens is that there is mass resentment and revolt against the French in Mexico, as suggested by Cinco de Mayo. It's reaching a crest post-1865. And in fact, what happens is that by 1867, yes, June 19th, 1867, you have the French puppet leader, Maximilian, who is executed by the Mexican progressive forces under Benito Juarez. You should also know that the Mexican progressive forces were in a de facto alliance with black soldiers in blue, that is to say, black soldiers under the aegis of the United States government, who had the French occupiers in a kind of pincers movement, which leads directly to the capture and execution of Maximilian on, as noted, June 19th, 1867. And I think that that second Juneteenth is worthy of marking and worthy of celebration. Number one, it brings the process of enslavement of Africans closer to an end than June 19th, 1865. Second of all, there is an important lesson there with regard to trans-border cooperation between and amongst peoples of African descent, namely the enslaved in places like Galveston and the soldiers in blue that were aforementioned of Ebony Hue, and their cooperation with progressive Mexicans, because that leads to a conclusion, a positive conclusion, and a positive prospect for the future. So I think it's important to salute that second Juneteenth. Now, before I go further, I should go back perhaps and explain the title of this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1836. As that title suggests, I'm revising the traditional notion of Texas. You know the traditional notion that is taught in many schools in a misleading way, which is one of the reasons, by the way, where Texas reactionaries and conservatives have launched this demagogic campaign against so-called critical race theory, because they do not want an accurate history taught to our youth, because they do not want our youth prepared for this perilous future that awaits. In any case, what happens in 1836 is that a few years before, the Mexican government, under the leadership of a president of African descent, speaking of Vicente Guerrero, had moved to abolish slavery in Mexico. The freebooters and cutthroats who predominated north of the border in Tejas, the then Mexican province, led by the cutthroats such as Sam Houston and Stephen F. Austin, who so arrogantly bequeathed their names to leading cities in what is now the state of Texas, speaking of Houston and Austin, amongst others, they were reluctant to go along with this abolitionist decree. So they revolted. And in that respect, listeners would be well served to see this volume as a companion volume to my earlier book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, wherein I argue that the vaunted and fabled so-called founding fathers, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Patrick Henry, all of whom happened to be enslavers of Africans, by the way, they too revolted and seceded, in that instance, from the British Empire, rather than accede to what they thought was around the corner, i.e. abolition of slavery, as evidenced by Somerset's case in 1772, where London said that slavery would not obtain in England. There was a fear that that decision in 1772 would leapfrog the Atlantic and jeopardize fortunes in enslaved Africans, large and small. And once again, rather than acceding to that decree, these freebooters on the northeastern seaboard and the southeastern seaboard of North America decided to revolt and establish the nation now known as the United States of America. And rather quickly, these enslavers had ousted the Spanish from domination of the trade in enslaved Africans to Cuba. That's by the 1790s. And by the 1840s, the United States of America was predominant in the trade, the odious commerce and enslaved Africans to the deepest and most liquid market of all, speaking of Brazil. However, it's fair to note that with regard to that latter market, the United States of America had stiff competition from, you guessed it, the Republic of Texas, established in 1836, lasting until 1845 as an independent country. Listeners should know that during that brief period, the so-called Republic of Texas was a leader in the trade in enslaved Africans, challenging the U.S. domination of the market to Cuba. You should know that the Lone Star flag could be found off the coast of Brazil as well. Interestingly enough, the trade in the bodies of enslaved Africans in Brazil accelerates coincidentally enough during the period when Texas was an independent country. That is to say, the period leading up to 1845. And so your listeners should also know independent Texas could not withstand abolitionist pressure, not only in North America, but from London, and particularly from revolutionary Haiti. Indeed, Haiti had good reason to object strenuously to the continuation of both slavery and the slave trade in this hemisphere, because Haiti had good reason to believe that if both of these hateful processes continued, there was a real danger that the enslavers of Galveston and of Dixie at large would decide that it did not make sense to sail vessels thousands of miles across the Atlantic to Angola to capture, manacle, and enslave Africans, bringing them kicking and screaming across the Atlantic so that they could toil for free in Southeast Texas in what comes to be called sugar land on sugar plantations. Why should they go all the way to Angola when you had all these Africans in Haiti? So Haiti had good reason to develop a navy, for example, to try to intercept slave ships. Of course, the fact that Haiti had to spend so much on its military meant that it had correspondingly less to spend on education and healthcare. And that is one of the many reasons why Haiti is routinely depicted today as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. So in any case, independent Texas could not stand the pressure from abolitionist Haiti and its comrades. So it chose to join the United States of America in 1845, although there is a legal footnote that I should mention, which is that as an independent country, Texas should have received a supermajority of votes in Congress in order to join the United States of America, which it did not. It received a simple majority. And so there is a question as to whether or not Texas entered the United States legally, which would make Texas a null and void member of the United States of America. And I'll let the lawyers sort that one out in turn, work to do in Texas. But fortunately, there is room for optimism amidst the gloom and doom. Texas, as noted, contains the largest Black population in the Union. This is the population most willing to cross swords with the neo-fascists, voting against the Republicans, at times at a rate of 9-1. We also have the advantage of being positioned on the border with Mexico, and with the emergence of AMLO, the president of Mexico, López Obrador, as the leader of a progressive bloc in the hemisphere. Note his triumphal visit to Havana, Cuba, just days ago. There is the possibility of us striking alliances with our comrades and brothers and sisters south of the border, not only in Mexico, but I should add, in Cuba as well. We also know that if present prognoses hold water, that Haiti will be joining the African Union shortly and then can play a role not only in the African Union, but in the Caribbean community, CARICOM, in helping to bring international pressure against these neo-fascists in Texas and in the United States in a way that they brought pressure on their ancestors, speaking of the enslavers in the 19th century.
Dr. Gerald Horn holds the Morris Professorship of History in African American Studies. His research has addressed issues of racism in a variety of relations involving labor, politics, civil rights, international relations, and war. He's the author of many books, including a new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1836, Texas, Slavery, and Jim Crow, and the Roots of American Fascism. Roy Ayers, Black Family. Happy Juneteenth. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. In 1978, music producer Kenny Gamble and his former wife Diana Williams created the Black Music Association and founded Black Music Month. According to Vibe magazine, President Carter declared June Black Music Month with the first Black Music Month event at the White House. June 1979. Diana Williams discovered in the late 90s that President Carter didn't issue an official decree. She worked with her local congressional representative to draft House Resolution 509, better known as the African American Music Bill, resulting in the official recognition of Black Music Month in 2000. The bill, signed by former President Bill Clinton, called for a formal acknowledgement and celebration of Black music's contribution to and impact on American life and culture. This is the spirit in which we observe Black Music Month today. On May 31st, 2022, President Joe Biden declared June 2022 as Black Music Appreciation Month. Today, in honor of Black Music Month and Juneteenth, we pay tribute to all the unsung blues composers and musicians, including the great John Lee Hooker, who said, quote, "The one thing the blues don't get is the backing and pushing on TV and radio, like a lot of this garbage you hear. They choke stuff down people's throat, so they got no choice but to listen to it." John Lee Hooker was born on August 22nd in the early 1900s. He was the son of a sharecropper and became a prominent electric guitar player, composer, and songwriter of the Delta Blues. Hooker was a gifted storyteller and developed his own classical boogie rhythms. Here's an interview of the late John Lee Hooker in Houston, Texas, 1984, backstage at the KPFT Juneteenth Blues Festival with a live recording of his music in the background.
This is Bill Barlow here backstage at the 8th Annual Juneteenth Blues Festival here in Houston, Texas at the Miller Theater Outdoors.
talking to one of the stars of the evening, a man who really broke up the audience tonight with his famous boogie, none other than the boss of the boogie, Mr. John Lee Hooker. John, good to have you here in Houston and at the festival.
And thank you very much. I'm very glad to look forward to every year coming here, because I know I call this home the Juneteenth. And so if I don't come, I feel left out. So,
how many of these festivals have you been making since they started, John?
I think this is the fourth one. I'm not sure, but I think so. It's the fourth Juneteenth festival, and I love it. I love the people, good audience. Everybody loves the boogie. When they boogie, I boogie. And I just can't keep it in. But that's why they called me the boogie man, because I knows how to rock you.
How did you develop that famous boogie rhythm and beat, John? And I know you did it in your early days in Detroit, but how did that come to you?
Well, my stepfather, I guess you read about that a many times. He was doing that, but he never got famous. And I took it up from him. And I started playing. I was playing at the age of 12 or 13 years old. I was playing guitar.
This was in Clarksdale, Mississippi?
Yes, it was. And I left there when I was 14. I figured I was, hey, I'm good, you know? And I came, I never get famous in Mississippi. And I started drifting and roaming through Memphis, Cincinnati, and on into Detroit. I got into Detroit, I was about 18 or 19 years old. And then that's where I grew up there. Grew up there and raised my family there until after we divorced it, I moved out to California. Been there ever since. I found it really good out there. I like the country, and I just love people.
You mentioned your stepfather had something to do with that, helping you with that old boogie rhythm. He in the Clarksdale area?
Well, yes, he was particularly around the parties, country clubs, and stuff like that. And that was his beat, his style, but I developed it and put a bigger drive to it. You know? But that was the direct thing that he was doing then. He would play, and he wouldn't play on the meter, he wouldn't play on time. He didn't worry about, the 12 bars, the 8 bars, just play. So that's the way I do it. And then I was very, very, very successful with playing that way. And I wouldn't change. I could change if I wanted to. I got to play direct on the meter, everything I do. But if I did that, that wouldn't be John Lee Hooker anymore. So I got to stay me, you know.
You've become a real international symbol of the blues and of the music now. You've not only toured nationally, but internationally. You've won awards. I know you've been honored at the Mississippi Delta Blues Festival, the Detroit Blues Festival. You've probably been every blues festival in the country. And as a sort of a symbol and a representative of the blues, maybe you could say something about what the blues mean to you, John Lee, as a person and as a musician.
Well, that's a big question, but the blues go so high. The blues won't have an end. Just go on and on and on and on and on, like eternity, like the world will never end, but the people will end in it. That's the way the blues are. They'll never die. Every style come from the blues. Ballads, rock, everything. The blues is the roots of everything. It's hard to explain what it means to me. It means everything to me. And the blues keep me going. It keeps me, I don't know, when I'm down, it picks me up. Picks up a lot of people. But nowadays, the whole world is in an uproar, I guess you know that. And that's what makes the blues. When everybody's, is really going around, having problems and stuff like that. That's the blues. And they've been here ever since it's been a world. They've been here ever since even Adam was here. And when they brought the blues here and placed them in the garden, they broke, and they started men, women, man against wife, wife against man. They leave the man is very unhappy, the woman is very unhappy. Can't sleep, and that's the blues. Then they want to go out and get loaded and hear some blues.
Do you think that international appeal of the blues has something to do, that it has certain universal qualities to it, and that everybody experiences failures in love and down points in their life, and that allows them to identify the music with the music, even though they might not even understand the language, they can just get the feel?
I'm so glad you said that. The blues is like an Eden castle. You take. I go to Europe all the time, all over Europe. The people, they don't understand the language, like you said, but they feel that feeling. This, the tone coming from you, the rhythm from your voice, the rhythm from your guitar. They feel that in Nura. And you see them sitting there, you know, with this rocking. I go over there, they know those songs. When I go over there, I'm just like the president coming. Well, maybe more. I'm just like the president in that country. When I get to a concert that night, this is the truth. They lined up there maybe 2 hours before I get there, all around the place. And they're, no matter if it's raining or what, they stand up, the Amor Brothers on, they, you know, they get in, they open the door to get in. And you know that makes me feel good when I see that. Now, next month, we're going to Tokyo. They've been trying to get me over there for the last 7-8 years. Now, they don't speak the English, I mean, English. But like you said, you hit it just right. They don't speak it, but they feel it, that rhythm. And so, and I can't wait to get to those people, you know, to give them what I got. Because you don't find many blues artists say what I'm going to say now. I do not belong to myself. I belong to the public. They owns me. But they the one put me here on where I'm at today up here. And I belong to them, and I love them, you know. And I don't run in my dressing room and hide out. I go out there. I talk to them. I'll sign autographs. I want to get to know them. And I want them to meet them. I don't care who they are, old, young, whatever. I just love them. The people, you know, the human race, and they doubted him, they didn't pay their money or whatever, how they got that of him, they didn't, he wouldn't be there.
Well, they sure love you, or they wouldn't have come out here tonight the way they have and filled up 25,000 strong to see you. And John Lee, we want to thank you for taking a few minutes out and from your schedule and coming back here and talking with us here at the 8th Annual Juneteenth Blues Festival. We've been talking to John Lee Hooker.
That was the legendary classical blues composer, musician John Lee Hooker, backstage in Houston, Texas, at KPFT's historic 1984 Juneteenth Blues Festival, which was, at that time, the largest blues event in the world. This is Black Music Month, and you're listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Texas House Bill 1016 was created by the late State Representative L. Edwards and passed in the 66th Legislature regular session, declaring June 19th Emancipation Day in Texas, a legal holiday in 1980. Molly Taylor Stevenson Scott is a former model and the daughter of the late iconic Benjamin Franklin, Big Ben Stevenson, who was a football star at Tuskegee Institute. Molly Jr. and her mother, Molly Stevenson Sr., were the first living African-American women inducted into the National Cowgirl Museum and Hall of Fame. She and her husband, Ulysses Scott Jr., are educators, teaching youth and adults about Black cowboy culture and agriculture in the South. Here's P.K. McCary of KPFT's Juneteenth Collective and Molly Taylor Stevenson Scott, founder of the American Cowboy Museum.
Molly, tell us a little bit about what your legacy has been as it relates to the history of Black people, especially here in Texas.
Okay. And we initially want to thank you, KPFT, Akua Holt, and Dr. Lynn Chu, who is now deceased, for originally introducing me to PKT. KPFT is a volunteer. We are so fortunate, I say we, not just Scott, Elisha Scott, my husband, and myself, but other family members, to live on areas of the Taylor Stevenson Ranch, which is just south of NRG Stadium or the Astrodome, between 610 and Beltway 8. We have always shared in a grand heritage of family, the Black Cowboy, volunteering in the community. And for Juneteenth, I remember it so very well since I graduated from Jack Yates in 1963, which segregation was still very prevalent. Mother and Daddy realized this and opened the arms of the ranch to little Black kids to come to, since we couldn't go to parks or theaters. Mother and Daddy, Mother Molly Taylor Stevenson Sr., who I'm named after as Junior, and my dad, Benjamin Stevenson Sr., were instrumental in being not just mothers and fathers to us, but a host of other children. Jack Yates' daddy was a coach at Booker T. Washington for many years. And when the children would come and visit, they would ride the horses. We would have games. Sky Ranch, which was an aviation school, was located there during the late 40s and early 50s. But two men initially had the vision, Hewlin White, Ray Thomas, and Miss A. White, who recently died. She was about 106. She passed years ago. Oh, and for Miss A's heritage, she was the first licensed African-American lady in Texas. So Juneteenth was very special to us. When Mother was born, Almeda was a dirt road. The midwife was brought to her. And over the years, it became two lanes and now surrounded by 610, 288 freeway, and other developments. So with Juneteenth, it was a day. It was really one very happy day that we could go, Black kids and Black folks could go to this park, which was called Playland Park, just south of the medical center. And that was a huge Ferris wheel, pony rides, roller coasters. But we knew that once it began to get dark, we had to go home, and we couldn't go back until the next June the 19th, a year later. Of course, there were the parades, rodeos, presentations. Some of our friends that we played with on a regular basis, one was always turning flips and outrunning everybody. The other was very poised, and the brother pretended to be a musician, and that was the Allens. Debbie Allen, Felicia Allen, and Tex Allen, and their mom, Vivian Ayres Allen, introduced them to a variety of culture, even taking them to Mexico to learn ballet folklore. And their presentations all over the city. Melissa Thibodeau is known for her adaptation of Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks. Fort Bend has activities there. Shape Center has something all year round with Deloitte Parker, so we encourage folks to go there.
Earlier, Molly, you were talking about all the places who have a historical connection to Juneteenth, and not just Shape Community Center, which is one place that we have done that, the Community Artists Collective, TSU. Mm-hmm. But there were other places that you were talking about who have been doing this for several decades, and since 1865, we trotted down to Houston. That's why we have Emancipation Park. But name some of those other places that people ought to think about when they're wondering what to do on Juneteenth.
On Juneteenth, other facilities would be the Emancipation Park, which is off of, it was Dowling, that some may recall, but it's Emancipation Boulevard, a street now. Of course, Galveston, where General Granger came in, it was announced that the slaves of freed in Texas, and this was 2.5 years after Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, which was a joyous day for many. But there were some slaves that did not want to leave the plantation because this had been their security. They had food, somewhere to reside. And there were cruel conditions. the beatings, lynchings, all kinds of things that were very...
injustices.
Yeah, injustices. The Shrine of the Black Madonna has is open for various people to come and visit. Larry Callis with the Black Cowboy Museum in Rosenberg. And, of course, with our American Cowboy Museum, whose mission is to preserve the Western heritage of Blacks, Hispanics, Native American women, we are by appointment, preferably late in the day, it's both indoor and out, and we are cautious of this extreme heat. Our phone number is 713-884-7460. I'll repeat it, 713-884-7460.
Some people might not know that Molly Jr. and her mother were the first African-American women inducted into the National Cowboy Museum and Hall of Fame. And you keep that light shining. You know, maybe many don't even know that you were a model, that you were your mother's pride and joy being named after her. And that you have made it a point to make sure that children know about this heritage, especially, you know, the cowboy wasn't run by just white men. There were black men, black rodeo, Will Pickett. Tell us a little bit about why this historical ranch is so important to you and what happens here in Houston for the children to know about it.
It's important to keep the history alive, and I say alive with not only the oral histories of the family, but where they could meet Scott and I in person, their artifacts that could be shown, walking on the land, actually walking on the dirt of an area of Taylor Stevenson Ranch. My great-grandmother, Ann Taylor, was purchased as a slave, and her actual grave is there. And there are times, you know, I kind of get down in the dumps and say, oh, my back is a little sore, I'm tired. But when I go to Ann's grave and be rejuvenated, E.R. Taylor and E.W. Taylor both were kind to her in having left the property to their six mulatto children, which I knew all of them because I was in junior and high school when they passed. And in closing, with the traveling exhibit, we can come to you with the heritage. Again, the phone number is 713-478-9677.
Thank you.
Thanks to P.K. McCary of the KPFT Juneteenth Collective and Molly Taylor Stevenson Scott of the American Cowboy Museum. Molly received the Chester A. Reynolds Memorial Award, one of only two women to have received the honor. Molly Jr. founded the American Cowboy Museum, which is located on the Taylor Stevenson Ranch, an historic working ranch in Houston, Texas, originally purchased in 1875 by her great-grandfather, Edward Taylor. Her ranch is among the oldest African-American-owned ranches in the United States.
I was walking down the street one day when I heard this voice say, who are you? He seems so blue. So I said my name. I looked into his eyes, he started to cry. So I asked him why, and he said, I heard the truth was in my roots, but I haven't seen a tree all day. I didn't understand who was this man, so I tried to ask again, and he said, I'll see.
That was Broken Branches by Fertile Ground. Happy Juneteenth. This is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Makua Holt. Oakland parents, students, and teachers have organized a liberation school, and they have occupied Parker Elementary since May 25th to protect this important institution from closure by the district, along with 10 additional schools. This Juneteenth weekend, Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed Rochelle Jenkins, a Parker parent and one of the organizers of the Liberation School, about the struggle to defend public education and schools in the Black community.
We're coming up on Juneteenth and the fight around Juneteenth, and how is that connected to what's going on at Parker Elementary?
It's very connected because, see, with my people, we have been dealing with oppression and being uprooted for over 600 years. And it's like, with me knowing that personally, I'm like, when are we going to get tired? Why do we keep allowing this to go on? Enough is enough.
And this occupation, this liberation school, what does it mean? I mean, to have a liberation school?
It means everything. It means that everything that our regular school board won't do or won't give us, we're able to give it to ourselves and to our children and to our community.
So what kind of classes are going on here?
We have a STEM class. We have a language arts. We do reading. I do the PE portion, and my son, he does the skating portion of the day. They've been getting taught sewing, everything. Everything that should be going on in this school, you know, that's what we're doing.
And this school is in a Black working class community, and they're saying they want to close it. And most of the schools, I think all of them, are in Black Latino communities. What does that say about their respect for these communities?
They have none. That's what it says. They have none at all. And we're tired of it. That's why we're here. That's why we're showing them we don't need none of you up there to come do what we're doing today.
And the politicians in Oakland, they pass resolutions for reparations. They pass all these resolutions to say that they're against racism, but it seems like this closing this school is an act of racism.
It is. Just like, you know, it's part of their whole gentrification scheme thing that they got going on. I told the school board, a week ago, gentrification is an aggressive form of racism. And they know it. You got all these billionaires coming down here. And it's modern day colonization as well. Because they see something that they want, they'll come down here, buy it all off, and then put the people that were originally here out.
And I heard that, Larry, the developers are even taking pictures of this school.
Yes.
Because they're already pricing it out for luxury condos.
Right. I'm serious. I'm like, they've been down here looking at the neighborhoods, taking pictures of this, taking pictures of that, taking pictures of the people. Because I'm like, we already know what you guys are coming to do. That's why we're still in the school. So take a picture of this, of us being here.
And, you know, the idea of this school is important for the community. It's a community center. How is the school important for this community? What would it mean if it closed?
Well, my two daughters, who are former members of Parker, they will have to walk a little bit further to another school. And then the other kids, they're going across town and just being completely dispersed. They have no yellow school bus system to pick any of these kids up. So these kids have to walk through war zone after war zone just to get to school, and they're putting their safety at risk. We told OUSD this, and no response. They don't care.
So these kids could be injured or even killed trying to get to their school.
And not only that, there's like human sex trafficking and stuff going on around these areas. And we have some beautiful little girls that walk these streets just to get to school. And who's to say that they won't come down and pick one of our kids up and have them out there in a little human sex trafficking ring?
That's frightening.
It is frightening for whatever reason, I guess, because the people that's sitting on the board of OUSD, they don't have to live in it and they don't have to see it. And they turn, they got blind eyes and closed ears to it. It doesn't exist to them. They act like we're, talking in fables and tall tales and stuff. And I'm like, no, this is real. This is what's going on down here. And you guys know why it's going on down here.
And the city council wants to spend $850 million for a stadium for this billionaire John Fisher, who actually supports charter schools, the Kip Charter and Rocket Ship. Why would they, where do they get $850 million for a stadium, but they can't keep the school open?
I tell you, it doesn't make no sense. It makes me think that, you know, it's a bunch of lunatics sitting up there. Because I'm like, any educated person will know that, okay, let's straighten out some of the things that's going on here in our city first, and then we can think about, you know, things that, you know, are considered a luxury or whatever. And I'm like, we can get that another day. Right now, we got problems going on. So why are you guys worried about a fancy stadium when you're doing this?
And how have people been changed by this Liberation School? Has it changed people's thinking about things? What you're talking about?
It has. It has. You know, it raised more awareness than anything. And it's like the highlight for me is when I see the children getting up and getting involved. They're starting to get, you know, politically aware. They're starting to see the power of people, the power of community, and what it can do. And children,
so they're excited about education.
Yeah, children are our future. I'm like, these same children just may grow up one day to change this whole community, or maybe even the world.
That was Rochelle Jenkins, a Parker Elementary school parent and organizer in the fight against public school closures in Oakland, California, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. Classic music by Texas own Milt Larkin, Stormy Monday. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of COVID, Race, and Democracy, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. In my career, people in the record business have been rocking in the same old boat. They all crooks. I'll say it clear and loud. They all crooks, especially the big ones. John Lee Hooker.